Welcome to the next episode of the podcast. Today we've got a Clinical Pearls case study episode for you. I thought we'd take a little break from the usual setup. This is a joint episode with Dina Farage, who's a clinical pharmacist over at Meditrax, and Amy Bowen, who's been on the podcast previously. Dina's an expert in her field, and we break down three case studies, medications in elderly people living in residential aged care. I plan on having occasional episodes where we talk about clinical case studies, medications, diseases, and I'm working on getting it actually certified as CPD so that these clinical episodes can also be recorded as additional professional learning. On a personal note, I just want to thank all the listeners. I've had a lot of really great feedback. I started the podcast just about a month and a half ago, and we've already reached over 1,200 downloads. So I wanted to thank everyone. I didn't think it was going to get this many. It was sort of a bit of a pet project, but it's really gained some legs, and we've got, you know, a dozen episodes ready to go because there's been so many people contact me keen to talk about their models and talk about things that they would like to discuss. So I am really honored by the response, and I just wanted to thank everyone. So without further ado, I give you Dina Farage and Amy Bowen for a live RMMR. Hi, Dina. Thank you so much for joining us today. We've got myself, Amy, and you here today to do a special Clinical Pearl episode. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do and what an RMMR is?
Okay, well, firstly, thank you for having me. This is a great opportunity to be able to speak to yourselves and to the nurse practitioner world. Okay, so I'm a clinical pharmacist. So I have been a pharmacist for almost 20 years and have been doing clinical work for a big majority of that. So I'm an accredited pharmacist, which means that we are able to partake in medication management services. Which brings me back to your question of RMMR. So RMMR stands for Residential Medication Management Review, which is the service provided in residential aged care facilities to residents on medications. You know, obviously there's, certain criteria for which RMMRs are eligible, but certainly most residents in residential aged care facilities would be eligible to get an RMMR, and certainly a lot of benefit around the use of those reviews.
Mm. And Amy, we've had a few RMMR discussions previously. They are an incredibly valuable thing for us to be able to use, and for the GPs to be able to use. You've had a lot of experience with them as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I've found in my practice of aged care, using the RMMR as a round table discussion has been an amazing asset. We sit there with the clinical pharmacist. We provide really good clinical background information on the patient, being the practitioners that know them the best. And that really helps the clinical pharmacist to do the RMMR to the best of their ability. And we get the amazing opportunity to learn from the pharmacist and be updated on all the best evidence around the medications that the patient's on. So it's an absolute godsend.
And how long have RMMRs been done? And like, has this been just recently introduced, or has it always been a thing?
Okay, so as far as I'm aware, it's at least been in place since 2004, but perhaps a little bit prior to that even, but I can't give you an exact date, but definitely throughout my entire clinical pharmacist role, that has certainly been available to aged care homes. So it's a well-established system. As you can see, it's 18 plus years now. So we have had a lot of changes over the years with regards to awareness around RMMRs and the increased involvement and collaboration with GPs and NPs. And so as Amy just mentioned, we are having a lot more roundtable discussions of cases, which are certainly beneficial for us as clinical pharmacists to sort of identify some history parameters or, you know, reasons why something's given over something else, and sort of allows us all to sort of have a good conversation around medication use, and choose what's best for the resident.
And I guess the question would be that why is it necessary, and why wouldn't the GPs or the NPs or whoever the prescriber is be able to kind of, is it like an additional tidbit, or were there errors made in the past, or was it like a growing area of concern with polypharmacy, or what was the reason for having this second input from yourselves or from pharmacy in general?
Okay, so look, I think, multiple reasons for that. often GPs are inheriting, GPs and NPs are inheriting residents that come, you know, from the community into an aged care home and that their GP doesn't follow. So certainly knowing their history helps, and that's not always known. So we perhaps would have the time to go through a lot of the history if that's, you know, able to dig through some hospital discharges or even health, e-health, so PRODA, to see, you know, why somebody's on something or what their medical history might have been. We dig through perhaps pathology, and then we are medication experts. So that's also a really good point to raise. So as much as, you know, doctors and NPs are amazing with their diagnostics, you know, we might be able to point out simple medication-related adverse effects or interactions that may have been overlooked.
Mm. And tell us a little bit about Meditrax.
Okay, so Meditrax is a specialist in medication management services. So they employ a large number. I think we're about 20 clinical pharmacists at the moment. And so we, you know, work together, we collaborate to ensure that we're talking about clinical aspects together and certainly look at, you know, improving our own practices across the board. Yeah, so that's really what we are. We provide RMMRs within aged care homes, but we have a huge number of other services that we provide, including education. We are members of the MAC committee within each home so that we can have input into medication management in the home. We also do audits. So that might be things around, say, psychotropics or SA management or, you know, whatever the home really does require in terms of attention. We try and work with the home to ensure they optimise their medication management.
Mm. And who funds you? Is it government or is it private or...?
Okay, so currently it's the government has subsidies for each of the services, but there may be outside, you know, funded audits or other sort of services that the facility would speak to Meditrax about.
Okay.
But generally there is an RMMR payment and there is a quality use of medicine payment by the government for each resident in aged care facility.
Okay. And tell us, what's your favourite part of being a pharmacist? What have you said you've been in it for 20 years. Obviously, you've stuck around for a reason.
Yeah, sure. Look, I do love the clinical work. I am a bit of a nerd when it comes to medicines. I do love updating myself. I love problem solving. So I love the challenge of having, you know, a resident that's, you know, complaining or having issues with certain aspects and trying to dig through what it is that might be causing it and trying to sort of solve that puzzle. So I do enjoy that aspect of work quite a lot. But I do also enjoy the education aspect quite a lot also, because I'm also currently the education lead at Meditrax. So we work with organisations to try and identify their gaps and see where we can support them from a learning perspective. So that's kept me out of trouble for quite a number of years. And I do love the flexibility about the job. That's also a really good thing, being a mother myself, mother of three children.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I love the RMMRs, and I always really enjoyed learning about the, like, down to the cellular level, like disease process and how things interact with each other. And I think it'd just be so fascinating. It's so, yeah, I thought about maybe even being a pharmacist back in the day, because I think it's a great role. What do you think, Amy?
Yeah, look, I think one of the things I get most out of the RMMR is learning about new products on the market as well. Even simple things like, you know, if someone's made a product which is a better strength in a smaller tablet for our aged care residents, that can be an absolute game changer, you know. So we always learn quite a lot from the RMMR process, and the GPs are always really happy to be involved, particularly because they get incentivized to read the RMMR. And very, very rarely is there not a very clever suggestion made out of it, which impacts the patient positively in terms of deprescribing or ability to swallow or just tweaking their medication so that there's less pill burden. You know, that's the best part about it for me.
Mm. And do you, Dina, do you ever get to see the positive outcomes of the changes that you suggest to the prescriber, because you sort of come in, you have a look at the case, you move back out again, I'm assuming. Do you get to see the fruits of your work?
I'll probably say half the time only. You don't get complete oversight. I think this is an area where we'd like to see increase. So the number of interactions or case conferences that happen with GPs and NPs will increase that visibility. But certainly getting outcomes back from the homes, we do get a lot of those. So we have, you know, awareness as to what's going on, but not all of them. That's the unfortunate bit. So, yeah.
Do you experience much pushback from the prescribers for your suggestions?
There's still quite a varied response. So there's still some that do push back and, you know, sometimes rightfully so, and sometimes it was, you know, unrightfully so, I believe. So I feel like sometimes they're not aware of a certain, you know, parameters of medications perhaps. But, yeah, look, I think it's definitely a very individual aspect for each GP or NP.
All right, awesome. So we've got a couple of case studies. I've got one and Amy's got two, and we thought we could do a RMMR for our listeners so they can see what it sounds like and they can come on a bit of a journey with us all.
Sounds great.
All right, awesome. Amy, you're up.
Yeah, unlike a normal RMMR, we've gone in blind here, so there's no pre-information
in the background. Dina has no idea what we're about to throw at her, so everyone needs to just understand that she's a real gangster, okay?
Yeah.
Totally off the bat, getting put on a podcast and, you know, awesome. All right, Amy, hit it.
Winging it. Well, so I've chosen a real patient and probably pretty typical of someone that we'd see come into our aged care facilities. So this little lady we're calling Myrtle, she's 93 and she's been brought into the RACF from hospital after a protracted stay in hospital, 16 weeks. She fell over at home because she was dizzy and she fractured her hip. And now she's so frail that she's been sent to the nursing home for palliative care. On arrival, she's drowsy with a low blood pressure of 95 on 55, pulse of 75 on regular, and a respirator of 10. Her background history includes hypertension, AF, CCF, gastrointestinal reflux disease, high cholesterol, iron deficiency, B12 deficiency, chronic pain from arthritis, multiple falls, and she's got depression and dementia. Pretty typical of what we would say, I would say, in our nursing homes. Mm-hmm. So the medication she's currently on is warfarin 4 milligrams titrated to her INR. She's on amitriptyline 10 milligrams at night for sleep disturbance, as well as temazepam 10 milligrams at night. She's on pantoprazole for her GORD at 40 milligrams in the morning. She's on atorvastatin for her cholesterol at 40 milligrams in the morning. She's on Lasix 40 milligrams in the morning for her CCF. She was put on Zyprexa or olanzapine 5 milligrams in hospital for a delirium following her hip repair in theatre. She's on Ditropan for incontinence. And since the broken hip, she's been on a Targin tablet or oxycodone naloxone 10 milligrams/5 milligrams. And as well as that, she's got a few over-the-counter medications, including a multivitamin, fish oil and glucosamine.
Wow.
Awesome.
Okay.
I was like frantically writing notes then.
And don't forget, we'll put a list of this case study in the show notes for you if you want to have a look at it.
Sounds good. Okay.
All right.
What are we doing about this lady?
Yeah, Amy.
Well, obviously, to kick it off, the first thing that comes to mind is that she's fallen over probably as a result of her psychotropics and opiates. So the combination of the amitriptyline, temazepam, Zyprexa and Targin would definitely make her a dizzy dolly.
Yeah, look, I think the first thing that strikes me is her anticholinergic burden. You might be aware of, you know, the concept of anticholinergic burden, meaning, you know, the higher the burden is with the medications that are currently prescribed, the higher risk of falls and the higher risk of, you know, further disease states being considered in that context. So the biggest anticholinergic medications in her regimen are amitriptyline and oxybutynin. But as you mentioned, also Zyprexa, so her olanzapine has anticholinergic as well as her temazepam. So that's certainly, and also just sort of the use of Zyprexa now, whether that's valid is another question because it was to treat a delirium.
So and I think I'm digressing a
little bit. I'm digressing a little bit, but I think maybe we'll go one at a time and talk about the amitriptyline being, you know, a highly anticholinergic agent, which certainly increases her confusion. And as you mentioned, she had a delirium and she does have dementia. Diagnosed. So that would be a big concern of mine, and that would increase her risk of falls quite considerably. And currently, the use of tricyclic antidepressants for sedation alone is not recommended. So in this case, you'd mentioned that it was commenced for aiding of sleep. And obviously it wasn't doing such a good job on its own because we've had to add temazepam on top of that. So, you know, you sort of wonder about that sort of prescribing cascade of medications for the same indications that sort of increase that burden. So I'd suggest that we withdraw amitriptyline slowly, and it has to be slowly so that they're not experiencing any withdrawal symptoms. And in relation to her sleep disturbance, it's, you know, I always wonder about what might be, you know, contributing to that, whether there may be pain involved in that aspect, and whether, you know, Temaz got prescribed prior to the Targin. You know, maybe the Targin came later. So having a bit of a timeline in place always helps me identify what came first, the chicken or the egg. So, yeah, so certainly knowing that, and once a Targin is commenced and is on regimen currently, doing some pain assessments around that, see whether that's adequate, and hopefully try and then reduce her sleeping medicines as a result. Now, moving on to Zyprexa, you know, looking at the fact that she's now in our care and in the home, I'd like to think that delirium has resolved. And looking at her current symptoms, I really would like to see that, you know, being reduced slowly. Also, 5 milligrams is quite a big dose for somebody you described who's 90-something years old, and I missed the exact numbers, but, yeah, but it's 40-something kilos. So obviously she's not a very big lady at all. And so 5 milligrams would certainly be having a profound effect on her. So I'd look at reducing that again and, you know, digressing a little bit again, but, you know, Zyprexa in that context would be a restrictive practice, and we need to identify whether it would be an appropriate, you know, use in this lady, which based on the information I was given by you, Amy, right now, does it sound like it's appropriate?
Mm. So just for any listeners who are, yeah. Olanzapine is a second generation antipsychotic, which has a very valid place in certain conditions, but it sounds like this lady, because she was delirious in hospital, antipsychotics, there are a few different kinds that are given to not sedate, but certainly bring the person's levels of agitation down, because if they're quite elevated during the delirium, they can cause injury to themselves or others. So it's used sort of as a last resort and shouldn't be continued on because she doesn't have a history of psychosis. It's just to manage the delirium, which was in hospital. Sorry to cut you off there, Dina.
No, you've said it so beautifully. So well done. Yeah, you said the fact that it was last resort, and I'm glad you pointed that out. So that's really important to note in this context. And as you said, it's not really clear as to whether that is the case at the moment, so trying to reduce that. Yeah, so that's the first things that sort of stand out at me. Now, warfarin, she's got AF, so she's got reason to be anticoagulated, ideal. I wouldn't recommend we change the anticoagulation option. However, you know, wondering what her renal function might be and assuming it's non-valvular AF, because we weren't given any other history of valvular disease in that context, maybe we could look at switching her over to a direct anticoagulant agent, because she might be, you know, benefiting from the less drug interactions associated, you know, with those agents, particularly if she has antibiotics or anything that might interact with warfarin. Her INRs might fluctuate, and so that might be a good option, and reduce number of blood tests also for her. So that's a quality of life sort of improvement for her. Now we come to the atorvastatin. So she's on 40 milligrams of atorvastatin. Now her medical history doesn't really tell me too much from an ischemic perspective. So I'm told hypertension, AFCCF. Nothing stands out at me as to why she would require long-term statin therapy, basically because she's also experiencing falls and she is so frail, and falls are her main issue at the moment. And we know that statin therapy may be associated with muscular adverse effects, including weakness. I would consider looking at minimizing or even ceasing, if they're agreeable, the statin at this stage. I think it also comes down to, you know, discussing with the resident and their family, and it really has a huge, aspect of knowing what the family or the resident themselves want as their goals of care.
Mm.
What's your thought around the over-the-counter medications, the fish oil, glucosamine and multivitamin?
Okay. Look, I don't think too much of those complementary medicines in general. I don't think there's a lot of evidence, great evidence around their benefits if you have, you know, normal dietary intake. Now, with regards to fish oil, there has been some evidence that suggests it does increase bleeding risk. So, you know, especially in someone who's on an anticoagulant, that might be more relevant. So that would be one I would suggest, and particularly she's got GORD documented and she's on pantoprazole 40 milligrams. So I would be really looking at ceasing and suggesting cessation of the fish oil so we can reduce that risk of GI irritation and bleeding in general.
And the DITROPAN, that's, am I right in saying that's one of those medications that can impact on cognition?
Yeah, so DITROPAN, very similar to amitriptyline. Oxybutynon is also highly anticholinergic. And so to give you a bit of a quick pharmacology on what anticholinergic actually means.
Yeah, I was going to ask for the listeners that I think it's really good that we outline exactly what that is because it's a huge, it's a huge area, right?
It is a huge area. Okay, so we have, and I call our brain a big bucket of chemicals. And so we have a chemical called acetylcholine, which is responsible for our memory, arousal, a lot of other things, but yeah, really important. And traditionally, residents with Alzheimer's disease have a reduced amount of acetylcholine in their brain. And this is why we have developed, or the market has developed, drugs like cholinesterase inhibitors, which are donepezil, galantamine, and rivastigmin. And so what those three drugs do is they actually make more acetylcholine available by preventing them from being broken down. So the drug actually prevents the enzyme and hence prevents it from being broken down. So what we're doing with those drugs is that we're trying to make sure acetylcholine is more freely available. I know it's getting a little technical, but really what anticholinergics then do is they come and they block that acetylcholine receptor. So they essentially do the exact opposite. So thereby reducing acetylcholine levels, thereby increasing, you know, the levels of confusion or increasing symptoms of dementia in somebody who's already got that.
And there's a huge amount of medications that have acetylcholine.
Anticholinergic
burden. Some have more than others, but from what I understand, like most medications in some sense do have some kind of impact on the acetylcholine system.
Yeah, so a lot of medicines that we use, and we are very well aware as we're looking at residents as to what might be anticholinergic, and that's really high up in the ladder in terms of things to look at and see whether they really are required. Because, yeah, that would be, I suppose, the low-lying fruit for somebody who has dementia to try and reduce the anticholinergic burden to as close to zero as possible.
Actually, I've got a quick question. With the warfarin, you were saying, were you suggesting like a NOAC instead of the warfarin? And that's, I'm guessing, because warfarin's a bit yucky in terms of it, like you said, it interacts with a lot of different medications. And then you've also got to get those regular blood tests to make sure that your INR is in a therapeutic level. And the concern with the NOAC is to make sure that the renal function generally is okay so that you're clearing it properly, right?
That's exactly right. So, again, like I said, provided it's non-valvular AF, then direct oral anticoagulant agents, which we now call DOACs, are recommended. So the examples of that would be, for example, avixaban, like Eliquis. And so, yeah, the requirements for that is that GFR is greater than 25 mils per minute. So, you know, looking at their renal function would be important in this aspect. And we still do need to monitor hematology in some frequency, 6 or 12 months, for example, to ensure that everything's going okay. But certainly we won't be needing to do, fortnightly or monthly INRs as we do with warfarin. I had a case recently where this man was very stable on warfarin for many years. And so the GP was quite hesitant, and I sort of agreed at the time that it was, you know, no reason to change. Unfortunately, he had a cellulitis, and they commenced him on, I believe, flucloxacillin or maybe diclox, I'm not sure. And his INR went up to 10. So he did rush to hospital on that occasion. And so the hospital itself did change him over from warfarin, and he came back on one of the DOACs. So that was, an interesting case to really just kind of reiterate the fact that if someone can go on a DOAC, you know, they probably should if their renal function allows for it. Now, warfarin is currently the only agent that can be used in severe renal impairment.
Okay.
So that would be the only limitation to using a direct agent.
Amy,
so do you want to hear what actually happened to this little lady?
Please. Yeah.
Oh, so you've absolutely nailed it. So this little lady came in, her renal function was fine, and on cognitive assessment, she didn't have any evidence really of ongoing delirium or even depression. We changed the warfarin to a DOAC. We put her on apixaban. Tick. We weaned out the amitriptyline and temazepam and popped her on a short course of melatonin while we got her nighttime routines in place, and she was weaned off that 6 weeks later. She stayed on the pantoprazole, of course, because she was still having the blood thinner. We gave her a statin holiday, meaning that we got rid of her statin medication. She had a cholesterol of 3 and it had never been higher than 4 for at least the years that we could find. So we got rid of her statin for a week and all of a sudden her pain went away. We were able to completely get rid of her opiate and put her on regular paracetamol instead of the opiate. So she was no longer on the statin, no longer on the Targin. We weaned the Zyprexa completely with no adverse outcomes. She was on the Ditropan for incontinence, and once we taught her how to use her incontinence aids with independence, she allowed us to get rid of that as well, and we got rid of all of the over-counter the stuff as well, with absolutely no problems with her arthritis. It seemed that the statin was the thing that was causing her the most pain anyway. So in the end, she ended up on her DOAC and her PPI and a little bit of Panadol.
Wow. This is a perfect case scenario. And I'm very pleased you're able to get rid of the Targin as well. I sort of hadn't gone as far as that yet. Wasn't delving into that one just yet. But yeah, no, that's
great. What we find with this cohort of patients is that if you've nailed it again when you said that the GP's hesitant to change things. And sometimes these people are on doses of medications that were commenced in their 60s and 70s, and they've had weight loss, they've had frailty, they've lost muscle mass. Some of the things that they're just not, you know, they don't walk around as much anymore, so they don't have as much arthropathic pain. Sometimes the incontinence that was a big problem when they're at home, now that they're in care, is not a problem. And so it's exactly what you said, going back into their history, trying to figure out why these things were started in the first place, and then trying to look at the new picture with a fresh set of eyes to see what the current needs are and actually what's causing the problem. In this case, the statin, which is actually providing benefit years and years down the track, is actually providing the side effects today. And so at 93, would we want to prevent her in 10 years from having an acute MI? She's probably not going to be around to experience the benefit of the statin, but she's certainly getting the side effects right now. So that's one of those real win-win de-prescribing cases that we managed to do really well with.
Absolutely. And she's got much better quality of life. It's amazing. Wonderful.
Wow. Good on you, Amy. That was an awesome one. Can you tell me about glucosamine? I don't really know too much about it. What does it do?
Okay, so glucosamine is meant to pad your joints, basically. So it's supposed to add more of a buffer between your joints so that when you walk, it doesn't sort of, you know, click, or there's no bone on bone. Okay. There's some people, and as Amy said this, you know, there's knowing how they've benefited from it is important. Yeah. I've seen people in their homes, particularly not in residential aged care homes, but in their homes that have commenced glucosamine because they've, you know, their GP suggested it or their neighbour may have suggested it, and they've commenced and they swear that it's done the absolute best for them. They couldn't walk and now they can. And so these people I tend to say, okay, well, then if it's worked for you, keep it there. I'm not going to suggest ceasing it, but some people just say, oh, look, I don't think it's done anything, but I keep taking it anyway. You know, these are the ones that have helped to just look, maybe increasing the number of tablets or possible adverse effects with other medicines, maybe not beneficial in this case.
Okay. I've got a lady, we'll call her Patsy. Patsy's 83 years old. She's got a history of type 1 diabetes, high blood pressure, GERD, gout, anxiety, macular degeneration, some mild cognitive impairment. She's had a sacral pressure injury in the past. She's obese. And she's not very ambulant. In fact, she isn't ambulant at all. She sits in a shell chair most of the day. She is a lovely, lovely lady, and she's been in the nursing home for a few years now, and her mobility slowly declined to the point where she's not very mobile anymore. She also got ongoing pain to bilateral knees and ankles, which is being treated at the moment PRN with some diclofenac gel. Her other medications are vitamin D, omeprazole, 20 milligrams at dinner, allopurinol, 300 milligrams in the morning. She's got some eye drops, polytears, glucagon PRN for diabetes management. She's on magnesium, 500 milligrams BD. She's on irbesartan, 300 milligrams in the morning. She's on a statin, 40 milligrams in the morning, atorvastatin. She's on tramadol, 50 milligrams, 2 in the evening, because her pain in the ankles really flares up in the evening. And
did you say it was PRN diclofenac gel or the tablet?
Diclofenac gel, yeah. Then she's on metformin, 500 milligrams at dinner. gabapentin, 300 milligrams, 1 BD.
100 or 300?
300 BD.
300,
yeah. And paracetamol, 1 gram TDS.
And I hope she's on insulin.
Yes. So she is on 20 units at night of opt-insulin.
So she's on opt-insulin, yeah, on 20 units night.
Yep. She's obviously got
Have any short acting?
No, she's got a sliding scale and she has 3 monthly B12 injections. So
what's the sliding scale insulin? Is it NovoRapid or?
Yeah, NovoRapid. NovoRapid.
Okay.
That's it. 4 units if BSLs are between 14 and 20.
Yeah.
You've managed, Alex, to pick my two most hated medications in the elderly in one go. Well done.
Yeah. This medication chart frightens me a little bit. So, I'll let you do your magic, Dina, because...
Okay, so her main concern is ongoing pain of knees and ankles and her lack of mobility, so decline in mobility. Okay, I think I'd want to know so much more about this lady. This is obviously a really complex case because she's had type 1 diabetes, and that's important to note. She's not on type 2 diabetes, so her only option is insulin. And assuming she's had type 1 diabetes for many, many years, that would be perhaps, knowing her diabetes management would be important for me.
Yeah, well, I've got her bloods and recent sugars and everything in front of me. So feel free to ask.
Did she get a HbA1c done recently?
She did. It is 7.6.
Okay, and let me just go back. So she's an 83-year-old lady. Okay, so I suppose just from a diabetes perspective, the HbA1c seems somewhat reasonable, probably could be a bit better, but I wouldn't really push for any better simply because she is elderly, and a lot of the guidelines now suggest that, relax some of the guidelines, the parameters for the elderly because the risk of hypoglycemia would be great, and she might be at a higher risk of adverse effects associated with her hypoglycemia versus any potential long-term complications associated with that.
Yeah.
So 83 years old, she's, like we kind of said with the other case, she's probably not likely to live long enough to see any micro or macrovascular complications, with that sort of HbA1c level. So around the 7.5% is kind of where I suggest for somebody there. So that having said that, though, this is an average. And I do sort of delve into, particularly with type 1 diabetics, I try and delve into their BSLs a little bit more to try and see, is it just kind of 20 in the morning and 4 at night, and hence the average is somewhere in the middle.
So it's usually in the morning, it's about 5 to 6. In the afternoon between, 4 and 6, it's about 15, mid-teens. So you're 13 to 16 generally. 16's on the higher end. Usually it's about 13 or 14. So in the morning it's low, not low, it's lower, and then in the afternoon it spikes.
Okay. Well, then if she's going well with those sorts of BSLs, I just continue as is. Yeah, I don't see any reason to, and usually what I find as well, noting that they've got type 1 diabetes, knowing how long they've had diabetes for really helps me because you find that people have been managing their own diabetes for, say, 40, 50 years, and they really know what they're doing, and you did not mention dementia in this case. So usually they have a really good hold of how they feel, how they should manage their insulin. It becomes a bit more complicated, obviously, when people have dementia and that we're trying to manage differently to what they had before. So in this case, I probably wouldn't play too much with her current regimen. But the fact that she's got glucagon PRN is a big tick, and that's important. So we need to make sure they've always got stock of the glucagon PRN for Patsy should any incident occur. Now, with regards to hypoglycemia, just quickly touch on that. If she does suffer a hypoglycemic episode, they need to be aware of the treatment, which is 15 grams of glucose available in, say, half a can of soft drink, a glass of fruit juice, a tablespoon of honey, and then once their BGLs are above a certain range, which the GP would then document on their directive, then they would have a longer acting carbohydrate. And so in her case, I think what I would make sure she has very clearly is a GP directive for her diabetes management.
She does,
so that staff are very well aware of, you know, what is the point at which someone rings the GP and says, what do we do here? So the GP might have a wide range, for example, to say, you know, BGL between 4 and 16 is adequate. You know, if it's below 4 or above 16, please alert someone. Or it might be, yeah, so something like that. And what to do in case of a fall, if she has a fall or if she has an illness or if, you know, she's requiring additional medications like prednisone, for example, you know, times of illness where that, you know, BGL might be spiking, you might want to have additional therapy. And so having that sort of talk or directive available for staff to look at. So you mentioned she's got magnesium 500 milligrams, and I query that. I query, is it magnesium aspartate 500 milligrams?
Yeah.
Okay, so aspartate actually, and that's an interesting one I always raise, that only really delivers about 37 milligrams of elemental magnesium. So, you know, the fact that we feel like we're giving 500, it sounds good and therapeutic, but when you delve into the details of that supplement, it really only contains 37 milligrams. Per tablet. Now that's not very enough, or it's not adequate in any sense. But knowing why it is that we're giving it, so does she have hypomagnesemia? Does she have low magnesium levels? Or are we giving this because she's experienced cramps? Okay,
no.
So understanding the background behind that.
So the magnesium was on the low end, and it was low, and just recently in her bloods it was 0.67, which is on the low end of normal.
Okay. So in which case then I'd either, you know, I don't like saying give her more tablets, so I just often suggest other formulations, and there are many out there that deliver, say, between 100 to 300 milligrams of elemental magnesium so that you're able to still give that one tablet. Instead of saying, okay, I'm going to use that same formulation and give them 200, they need 6 tablets a day. Mm. And you might have seen a lot of hospital discharges, particularly for people with CCF, that come back and they're on 6 tablets of magnesium. That's, you know, not uncommon at all. And the reason for that is because of the amount of elemental magnesium that it delivers. So for her, I'd probably maybe recommend an alternate formulation or increasing current, which is my less favorite choice.
Okay.
Now, with regards to tramadol, you know, tramadol has been shown to be less tolerated in the elderly, okay? And we know they experience a lot of adverse effects with tramadol, you know, more often than other medications, compared to other medications. So, and I think the guidelines really do suggest against using it for anybody over 75. Not that sort of, you know, followed closely, but certainly from a practical sense, I'd like her to, you know, to be using other medications for that. Now, what is that? That's a really good question. I think... Yeah, so in her case, I would be veering away from a non-steroid or anti-inflammatory. Mm. Now, the reason for that would be the fact that she's on irbesartan, which, you know, is metabolized, you know, it works through the kidneys. And so adding an NSAID to that might be increasing her risk of acute kidney injury. So she doesn't truly have, you know, that triple whammy combination, because I don't believe she's on a diuretic. She still can have what, you know, very loosely I'll use the word as double whammy. So certainly increase the risk of acute kidney injury with the use of irbesartan and a non-steroidal.
Yeah.
So I'd veer away from that. Yeah.
So the triple whammy for anyone listening is concomitant use of ARB, angiotensin receptor blocker for blood pressure, like irbesartan, an ACE inhibitor, like ramipril or perindopril, and then on top of that, an NSAID, because they all act on the kidney and can cause acute renal failure.
Plus a diuretic.
Yes.
So the triple is a diuretic, yeah.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Sorry, go on, Dina.
Yeah, no, so maybe I'd veer away from having an NSAID. However, having said that, they can use it sporadically for absolute, you know, excruciating pain on PRN regimen in her case. So perhaps I'd recommend something like a low-dose endone in her case, mm-hmm. because it doesn't sound like she's getting a sustained release of tramadol anyhow. And I'd generally look at other reasons. Oh, she's also on gabapentin. I've missed that bit, haven't I? So she's clearly on gabapentin for her pain. Is that what that's for?
No, because she's had restless legs.
Restless legs.
Yeah, and she's had that for many months, didn't respond very well to lower dose gabapentin, and then was increased gradually as the years gone on, which has had some good effects. She's not as fidgety in the lower limbs anymore, but I should have mentioned that in the history, but that's why that's there. Right. She's got some neuropathic pain from what it sounds like in the lower limbs with the, with her pain and then, the restlessness.
Okay, so I suppose the fact that she'd had low magnesium makes me think that perhaps also her restless legs was exacerbated by that. Mm. But I'd also want to know her iron levels, and I'd want to know her B12 levels in this case, because restless legs is associated with a deficiency of both. So we'd like to sort of rule those two deficiencies out as possible suspects. Mm-hmm. And seeing as she's got quite a high dose of gabapentin and she's still using tramadol at night, I sort of look at whether we could try reducing that.
So her iron is just fine.
Ferritin. Oh, so you do have some answers. Sorry.
Yeah. I've got all the bloods here. Iron saturation is 36%. Ferritin's 171, and her iron itself is 15.7. And her folate was also very low when I first met her, so that's why she's on folate therapy. And her B12 was also low, which is why I supplemented her earlier in the year when I met her.
Wonderful. Okay, so there you go. So
I haven't checked it again on these new bloods, but that's because I've put her on therapy, and I think that test is a bit expensive as well. So I just haven't done that. I assume it's come up since getting 3 monthly injections.
Wonderful. Okay, so the B12 is going to hopefully help her restless legs considerably.
Yeah, so you're saying with the magnesium and the B12 being settled, maybe we can try and reduce down maybe that was actually the cause of the restless legs.
I suspect it played a big role. And I would suggest that we try and reduce some of the gabapentin simply from this, central nervous system adverse effects that are associated with that. I'd have to look at more into her pain. I realize I may not have provided a lot of solutions there, but I think maybe we need to also look at further exercises. I know she's not ambulant, but, are there any other strategies or physiotherapy sessions that can help improve her pains from a non-pharmacological point of view? I think that would be really helpful. Mm. And looking at if the diclofenac PRN is used, I think that's important. I think PRN medications are not always used very well in aged care homes. So if there's a reason, we could possibly put it on regular for a little while and see if that helps her pain and try to reduce the orals. But if all fails, putting her on some sort of a low-dose opioid for her pain, if everything else is ruled out.
Okay, amazing. I'll look into all of that.
Yeah, and also just on that, you mentioned her B12 was low. Mm. Just for our audience, so she's on a PPI, a proton pump inhibitor, omeprazole. So what all the PPIs do is they reduce the they have malabsorption of the minerals. So they do decrease the absorption of B12, iron, and magnesium, among others, and calcium actually.
It's always that trap, isn't it? That we're giving medications that are causing side effects or abnormalities in other things, and then we add medications in to fit. It's just that cascade that you see so often in polypharmacy, isn't it?
Mm. Definitely.
Do you think, are there any PPIs that are better than others in avoiding that? Because I was also thinking perhaps that's what caused her magnesium to trend downwards in the first place as well.
I suspect it may have played a role. Look, I don't think there's any comparative information as to what PPI would do that less. I believe the way they work, they all cause malabsorption of those ions, yeah.
All right. Amy, you're up. By the way, we've done x-rays and imaging to exclude any other pathology in the lower limbs and the pain. Yeah.
Well done. For anyone,
yeah. She's got a broken leg and we're just not even addressing that. No, her yeah. Anyway, Amy, you're up.
Okay, so this too is a real patient who came to me last week. She is a 97-year-old little lady who's not so little. She's quite centrally obese. She's got a background history of not very much. She's been previously very well. She's got some Parkinson's that was diagnosed quite late with quite a bad essential tremor. Just been started by the hospital on levodopa carbidopa at one tablet BD. So she's on the 200 milligram dose. Her biggest issues on coming in to me was a chronic cough that she's had for probably the last 5 years. She's got no history of COPD, but she has been started on Ventolin and Spiriva which she's not using very well because of poor technique. She's got profound ankle swelling, which is the biggest problem that she sees. She's got chronic pain in both ankles with 3 pluses of pitting and lots and lots of pain in the joint. And since that, she's not been able to walk very well. On arrival, she had a blood pressure of 65 on 42.
Oh, my God.
She was profoundly constipated when she came into me with really, really nasty tummy pain and said she hadn't been for probably 3 to 4 days. And she's got a long history of a chronic shoulder injuries, just a fixed shoulder from multiple ligamentous tears and a frozen shoulder type picture. Her medications from the hospital, which always interests me, that how does the hospital not pick this stuff up, right? Anyway, she's on Ferrograd C for mild iron deficiency. She's on 5 milligrams of perindopril, which she's taking in the morning. She is on temazepam at night to help her sleep. I've already mentioned the Ventolin and Spiriva. She's on pregabalin for pain twice a day. She's on a 10 microgram per hour Norspan patch. And she's on PRN endone, 5 milligrams every 4 hours to a maximum of 5 tablets a day, which she's been using for her ankle pain.
So say that dose again, 5 milligrams.
5 milligrams every 4 hours up to 5 tablets a day.
Oh, dear. Okay. Okay. So I think the elephant in the room is the chronic cough for the past 5 years. And straight away she is on an ACE inhibitor, so perindopril. So ACE inhibitors are commonly associated with dry cough. And so we would suspect this therapy is causing her symptoms. Now, she may not necessarily have, you know, the same symptoms if switched over to an ARB. So often that is a strategy. However, looking at her medical history and her blood pressure, I just would really get rid of it, I think. I don't know why she's on perindopril. As far as I can see, there's no, you know, cardiac history or anything like that. And she certainly does not have hypertension. So that would be the approach of ceasing her perindopril, hoping her blood pressure does come up and that her cough resolves. Now, we've started the Ventolin and the Spiriva for her cough, I presume, because mm-hmm. I don't also see another diagnosis for that. And so provided they've not diagnosed her with anything else that we're not aware of, she doesn't have a diagnosis of COPD or something, then I would also suggest that we review and discontinue her inhalers. So her other issues were ankle swelling. Now, that is not really as obvious. Perhaps the pregabalin, I would suggest, be reviewed in this case. We know that pregabalin can be associated with peripheral edema. Now, I didn't quite get the dose. You said twice daily, but what dose was she on, 75 or?
Yeah, no, on the 75, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. So 75 twice a day. So that's really a significant dose, you know, for somebody who's quite elderly. And also the peripheral edema is problematic. Yeah, so she's got joint pain in joints, chronic shoulder injury. So obviously they were trying to treat some form of neuropathic pain there. But I'd be more concerned about the ankle swelling and the pain that is causing. So I'd probably titrate that down, you know, as much as possible with the hope of ceasing, if possible, you know, depending on her responses and her acceptance. And I know that's probably a limitation in some cases. Okay. So what else have we got? Constipated, of course. She's on oral iron. So I'm sure that's all, you know, been obvious to you guys, but certainly oral iron is one of the biggest culprits of constipation. And in the home, it's one of the biggest reasons why people don't comply with their iron tablets. And so certainly looking at her blood levels, identifying whether she still needs iron, obviously get rid of this one. But if she does have a profoundly low iron levels or low ferritin, we would look at other options like ferinject if that is a continued problem. So I think that's it. Now, she does have a PD late onset, as you mentioned, so Parkinson's disease. She's been put on levodopa carbidopa. Now, that also can cause constipation as well as Parkinson's disease in itself. It can cause constipation. So we would want to still keep a really close eye on her bowels, and we would probably suggest some form of PRN medication, which I don't think she has. And, of course, she's on opioids. She's on Norspan and Endone, so constipation is a real big problem there. And I don't see an order at all for an aperient So the hand that writes the opioid is the right, is the hand that writes the apparent, is my general rule, with the exception of Targin, of course. So Targin includes naloxone, which is, prevents opioid-induced constipation. But yeah, in this case, she would require close monitoring, bowel management, and certainly some appearance charted.
Yeah, I think we've definitely got a triple whammy of bowel issues here. Parkinson's, TARD, like high dose opiates, and Ferrograd C. Wow.
Yeah. I'm surprised it's only been a few days, actually.
Yeah.
Have we not covered something?
Well,
obviously the endone dose, this is another really interesting aspect. So the endone dose really worries me, and the fact that she's using it so quite often is a problem as well. Mm. So, looking at some form of, understanding or assessment around her pain, whether she's requesting it due to, I suppose habit or, partially addiction or something else that's going on there that we're not recognizing, whether her pain is truly uncontrolled, in which case we need to think about her regular pain management and get others involved in terms of, managing that kind of pain. So if there may be physios or, other allied health that may be assisting in that department. So she's also ambulant, I think. So that might, be good.
Not ambulant anymore, no.
Not ambulant. Oh, okay.
Swelling, actually.
Oh, okay. Mm. So maybe hopefully if ankle swelling drops, we can get her to be a little bit more ambulant. But, yeah, exercise might be a limitation in her case.
Has the ankle swelling been going on for a while? Is it heart failure? Is it dependent?
No, it started when, so she had the shoulder injury and then was put on the pregabalin and the Norspan, and then the ankle swelling came.
Probably reduced mobility as well, right?
Yeah, and obviously she was in hospital. So by virtue of being in hospital for a period of time, she deconditioned because she wasn't mobilizing there either. Yeah. What's interesting to me too with this one, she'd had a fracture and no one had thought to put her on any osteoporosis treatment. And we often find people come in after an acute event, and that's one of those chronic things that you often doesn't get discussed in hospital and is left for the GP to manage or the primary physician to manage. So,
Is she a regular paracetamol?
No. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yes, thank you. Yes, I did definitely miss that. There you go.
So Amy, you've got a really nice trick with your paracetamol regimen if you want to share with the listeners.
Yeah, so long as they're a decent weight, so they're more than 50 kilos, what we do is we use, and that they can swallow sufficiently, we use a mix of the long-acting and short-acting, which doesn't take them over the 4 grams, but also reduces. So in aged care facilities, the burden of QID or 4 times a day dosing can be really labor-intensive. So we do the osteo tablets twice a day and then using the osteo late at night, so it covers them for more of the bedtime period where they're not getting anything. So we use 2 Panadol normal 500 milligrams in the morning at 8 o'clock, and then we give them 2 Panadol osteo at 2 and bedtime, and that reduces the rounds of the medication, and it reduces their pill burden by 2 tablets. Covers them a little bit better at night.
Don't you make it at 12?
Depends on the facility. I try and...
Because the nurses do their rounds that time. That's why. Because if the nurse is doing their rounds...
It's really difficult, I think, too, in the nursing home to get that ideal six-hourly gap between the paracetamol when their rounds don't coincide. And that's something that prescribers need to consider, is the ability of, the nurses to give it. Things like, Movicol is a perfect example, that the Movicol often is very labor intensive for the girls to give. It adds to patients' volume of fluid. If they're fluid restricted, they often don't have the motivation to sit and drink the whole thing. And that leads to nurses not putting it in enough fluid. The cascade happens. So out in primary practice, those prescribing details can make a real difference for both the patient and the staff administering them.
I thought that Macrogol and Movicol were designed in a way that actually doesn't add to their fluid balance. The electrolytes keep the water in the bowel.
Yeah, but they still have to swallow the powder in quite a lot of liquid.
Yeah, surely it adds.
And that's difficult for a lot of elderly people to do, particularly when it's plonked on their breakfast tray when they've already got a cup of tea and a glass of juice and then they've got Movicol. They just don't have room for it sometimes in their belly, Absolutely. So do you want to hear what happened with this lady?
Please do.
So her low blood pressure, you've identified she had been put on the perindopril about 20 years ago and had had several falls as a result of low blood pressure. As the Parkinson's caught up with her, she developed postural drop and no one had thought to deprescribe the perindopril, which was no longer necessary. So we got rid of that completely. We, as you said, stopped her Ferrograd and gave her a Ferinject infusion, which brought her anemia up and brought her iron stores up beautifully. We ended up stopping the endone because we stopped the pregabalin. Her ankle pain and swelling went down. She got up immobilized. We got rid of her PRN completely. We also, as you said, got rid of her Spiriva and Ventolin, given that she hadn't had it for some time because her technique was so poor. So she'd already given herself a trial off that. And the chronic cough went completely away once the perindopril was stopped. And we weaned her Norspan down to 5 micrograms per hour, which was enough to manage her chronic arthropathy. So she got up and walked, pain was better. She wasn't constipated. She wasn't coughing and she stopped falling over.
Amazing.
Come on. Surely you didn't do all that. That's like the perfect outcome, Amy.
I was hardly going to present something that didn't have a happy outcome.
You literally solved everything. Hold on, though. You have there's a temazepam still lying around in there. Come on.
Yeah.
Oh, no, we got rid of that as well, of course.
Oh, okay. How's her sleep, though? Is she sleeping well?
She still has the temazepam once a week, PRN.
Yeah.
On a Saturday.
When she,
I don't know why she wants it on a Saturday. Sometimes you've got to play to their little perks and quirks, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. That's definitely where less is more.
Awesome.
So doesn't this highlight, honestly, just that round table going through things and you can see with the three heads together and the more the better, that, you know, the benefit of knowing the patient, knowing the drugs and bringing all the guidelines in. It's just such a wonderful process. And I'd really encourage anyone who has the opportunity to sit with a clinical pharmacist and go through these medication reviews. It is education that you don't have to pay for that's like absolute quality.
Mm. Oh, that's a fantastic wrap. Thank you, Amy.
And Dina, did you want to, was there anything you wanted to sort of say about Meditrax or any shilling that you'd like to throw out there for any listeners or anything at all?
Well, look, I just probably should end with the fact that, you know, we are here to support, you know, organisations and support the resident, because the resident ultimately is our main goal. You know, ensuring that things are going smoothly within the home really does translate to better resident care, which is what we'd like to see, and that we are available. So wherever they need support, we are here, happy to take on, you know, curly questions. And as Amy mentioned earlier, you know, it might be as simple as crushing medications because something so small might have such a profound difference. So if unsure if they want alternatives about certain aspects of medication management, we are here. This is our bread and butter and it's what we love. So we certainly would love to be talking to anybody about helping them in that domain. So our website is www.meditrax.com.au. You can contact us through that, or you can get on to our main line of the office, 9819-0600. You can just Google Meditrax and hopefully you'll get all the contact information.
And Dina, if you have any suggestions about educational resources or websites that people can go to help them with medication-related issues, that'd be helpful.
Yeah. Look, for our facilities, we have MediLearn, which is an online education platform. It's an individual competency platform. So each individual staff member keeps track of the sessions they've done and they're able to sort of build on that. And, you know, that might be something that we'd love to see being utilized, you know, quite heavily. We also put out resources every quarter and we often discuss those in the MAC meetings. So all sorts of different resources for all the different topics, often, you know, brought together by facility need. And so it might be something around, say, antimicrobial stewardship or appropriate antimicrobial use in aged care homes. It might be around S8 management, opioid use. I mean, the list goes on and on and on, but certainly there's resources in every important aspect. Psychotropics, how did I not mention that? That's so important. And there's a lot of discussions around psychotropics, so there's a lot of good resources around that. And as I mentioned, we are able to, you know, utilise those resources to help homes improve their medication management. So, yeah, so that's that.
Yeah, thank you so much. That was awesome. We really appreciate it, Dina.
Thank you very, very much for having me on, Alex and Amy.
Thank you.
We'll see you guys around.
See ya.
See you.
Bye.
Thanks to everyone for tuning in. To join and strengthen our amazing community of nurse practitioners, follow us on Instagram at Australian Nurse Practitioner and subscribe to the podcast for free on all major streaming platforms.